Hello, Spacers. From Austin, Texas, I'm Christopher Schmidt. And on today's show, I'm talking with Miles Tillman and Rich Colardi that make up the leadership of Pixel Jam, an indie game development company. Since 2005, Pixel Jam has created their own video games, mostly in the retro pixelation format that defined the look and feel of the 1980s console games. They've made games such as Gamma Brothers, Dino Run, and Potato Man Seeks the Truth. However, some games that they've made have other visual styles, like my favorite, the Glorkian Warrior, which shows they can shed that retro style and still make an engaging game. Pixel Jam has also produced mobile games for late-night cable station Adult Swim, such as Retro Unicorn Attack, Hipster Kickball, and Pizza City. Some notes on where I'll be hosting the AccessU Summit on May 10th. It's a virtual one-day, one-track conference about advanced web and mobile accessibility. Learn new accessible knowledge without leaving the office. Individual meeting room tickets are available at accessusummit.com. Again, that's accessusummit.com. Also, I'll be hosting the CSS DevConf, which is happening in October 17th and 18th. It's a two-day conference in San Antonio, Texas that tackles CSS, post-CSS, preprocessors, React, JS, and so much more. Register now to pick up early bird tickets, as the prices will go up later. And you don't want to miss this event. It has Jonathan Snook, Rachel Neighbors, Sarah Drasner, Wes Boss, Chris Coyer, just great featured speakers. So check it out at cssdevconf.com. As for the podcast, you can get delivered directly into your email box with a non-breaking space show newsletter. So when the show is ready, just have it delivered directly into your email box by signing up at newsletter.nonbreakingspace.tv. You can find the show notes and links mentioned in the episode today at nonbreakingspace.tv. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at Teleject, T-E-L-E-J-E-C-T. And as always, thank you for subscribing, liking, and telling others about Nonbreaking Space Show on iTunes. Now, on with the show. We start off the show. I mean, this could be a different type of show because we were talking about independent game development, but we start each show with just saying and asking how you guys found the web and what was your first interaction with the web.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I don't know if you want to go first.
First interaction with the web. I'm going to guess mine was probably as a freshman or sophomore in college. Mm-hmm. And I think at that point it was like all, you know, it's just like a text interface. What was that thing that everybody used to, you know what I'm talking about? It's like,
was it Archie or Gopher? Or
right.
I think either Gopher or something like that.
Or BBC or something like, or like a.
I think it was Gopher. I was just given a text prompt and I had no idea what to type. Because, you know, it was accessing it through like a Mac and I was used to the graphical interface. Like, why do I have to know what to type? Is this a text adventure?
Kind of.
Like, find cool stuff that didn't exist at the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's definitely through a text prompt. That's my only memory of my first web experience.
I had heard about somebody on using some crazy computer chat space. I forget what it was old. It was like 90 maybe, or 89 or something like that. I heard about it. And I was like, that sounds cool. It sounds crazy complicated. I don't know anything about it.
Now, actually, I mean, like, does this stuff, like, on the Commodore 64, I saw advertisements for, like, playing chess with someone over the phone. Does that count? Like, it was through Prodigy, I think. Prodigy was the...
Prodigy was the bomb at the time.
That's what it was, Prodigy, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, that was like 85 or something, and I didn't understand it at all. And I didn't want to play chess with someone over the phone anyway. It was like the only thing they offered, play chess over the phone.
Right.
They had one feature.
It's like, chess, whatever, give me checkers, and then you might have me hooked.
I might have done that. I don't know if that's considered the web, though.
That's the internet. Really.
That was the internet, right. But you're talking about the web.
Right.
Yeah, that's, you know.
So,
and then I guess it was Netscape was probably the first like graphical
same here, yeah.
web experience I had.
Yeah, with horizontal rules and
horizontal rules
and the blue text, the blue links, and the purple visited links.
Links are still blue. All links, I don't know if you noticed, but all links are still blue.
And the spinning the spinning email me logo and logos.
Oh yeah, that's the little gifs. Yeah,
yeah. I think they existed by the time I got to the web.
Cool.
Yeah, that was a junior in college at that point.
Okay. Cool. And that was last year, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, so I guess we should also at this point, just if you guys can introduce yourselves, just so people who are listening can associate a name and with and what you do with your voice.
Yes. Yeah. I am Miles Tillman, and I am one half of Pixel Jam. I do the coding and kind of business development and music production and a lot of the marketing.
Right. And I'm Rich Gerlotti, the other half of Pixel Jam, official Pixel Jam. We work with other folks, but as far as the company itself,
we do everything.
It's just us two. Actually, it turns out close to that sometimes.
Sorry to
invite you. Anyway, yeah, I do art and design. What else to it? No, I have ideas. And
that's a full-time job.
Promotion and
Rich try makes to everything pretty.
Build things with Miles. Okay. Miles pretty much tells me what to do, and I do it. And I show him, is this good, Miles? He's like, no. Back to work.
I'd say Rich is the main character generator behind the Pixel Jam machine. The Dino, Potato Man,
Gamma Bros.
Yeah, so like, art direction and artist. And
yes,
and character creator and designer, and then for the actual design of the games, we do them together, but it's highly iterative. We design it over the course of a long period of time instead of sitting down and deciding when everything works before we start. But that's probably a totally different question that you didn't ask.
And we both collaborate on web design and interface, and I usually pretty it up and then we'll get somebody else to actually build it. Okay. I'm working on a web design today, actually. Might excite you. I don't know.
It's a people
who
might excite
you. No. It's just web.
So
it's not that kind of podcast.
So Pixel Jam, like when did you guys describe what it is, you know, just for audience, and when you guys first get started, and you know, what was the history of it?
So Rich's probably best qualified to describe the start Pixel Jam, because I was not even involved in it when it started.
Oh, actually, yeah, you were around for the start of Pixel Jam,
yeah.
Chris. I was gonna take Chris at the end of that. yeah, it was like 98, I think. I was at 3W Studios.
Yeah,
and I was just graduating, and I just was fascinated with zooming in Photoshop. You know, I'd find a photo or whatever, and I'd zoom all the way in, and these glorious pixels would fill the screen clean and beautiful.
So and after Photoshop added their zoom feature.
Yeah. It didn't quite zoom as far as it does these days, but I was, easily, satisfied with that. And then I wanted to see the move, and I just started doing frame-by-frame GIF animations of pixels moving. So, yeah, I just made a Pixel Jam as this idea of I was jamming with pixels, abstract animations, and I did version 1 and launched it as Pixel Jam.
I think you can still see that online.
You may. Well, you see version 2, I know. Oh, it's like okay. pixeljam.com/art, I think, is version 2. And that's like sunrises and sunsets in pixel style with Miles doing ambient music.
That must be there.
Yeah.
There it is.
There it is.
Still there.
And there's. I don't know if the email, what the hell that goes to. And the stuff is, there's no stuff. But go gets you where you want to go. But I don't think there's any going back to update this.
It's a flash,
you click it and then it proceeds on its own, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, Pixel Jam was abstract pixel art animation. And then a few years later, I was living in Chicago. This is after we all lived together in Orlando, Chris included.
Full disclosure.
You know, when we had that business down there. Yeah. I was like, I'm out of here, and took off to Chicago.
Yeah.
And then I eventually moved up to Chicago and lived with Miles.
And we were doing a lot of freelance. Well, I was doing a lot of freelance flash animation. Rich was doing a lot of photography, and we started working together on some projects. And then I don't know when the exact like moment came, but we realized, oh, Flash is developed enough so that you can make games in it. Mm-hmm. And Rich had just done a series of like Pixel People for an art show in mm-hmm. Chicago. And so he made some more Pixel characters in a more geared towards like gaming. And then I started teaching myself how to code, but not from scratch, because I, like I said, I'd done a lot of stuff on Commodore. I programmed a bunch of unfinished games on Commodore 64, so I kind of understood the logic of games, but I had never gone as deep as I did when we started. So we just kind of self-taught ourselves everything we needed to know, and a year later we released Gamma Bros, something like that.
And Game of Bros is your first game?
It's the first game we... the second game we started working on. It's the second game we shipped. Mm-hmm. It's the first big game we started working on. We stopped right in the middle and released Rat Maze, which took a couple weeks. Rat Maze was the first game we released. But it was not... I would say Game of Bros is like our first game, because we started on it before Rat Maze. Rat Maze was like a little diversion to break up the monotony of working on Game of Bros every day for 7 months or something.
Right, which I have to say was awesome.
It was really good times, and I think one of the reasons why we enjoyed it so much and it's still so fond in our memories is that there was really no, we didn't know about like the indie game scene. We didn't mm-hmm. even know what other people were doing. We knew that people were making Flash games, but there weren't really a lot of Flash games out there that looked like Gamma Bros. Like nobody had really kind of like intentionally embraced the super low res pixel style.
The only one was Cave Story that existed.
That's right. Cave Story was out. That was
right. But I hadn't seen that yet, actually.
I don't think I had either. And then we got an email from somebody that said, Gamma Bros is like the Cave Story of space shooters. And what he might have meant by that is that Gamma Bros is the only space shooter with low res pixel art.
Yeah, the modern space shooter. Yeah, like modern as of 2006.
As far as like scope and depth goes, Cave Story is pretty epic, and Game of Bros is pretty more casual.
But it's also epic, though.
It is epic. It's casually epic.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then, I can't even remember what the question was.
Well, I'll jump in. So how it started. So it was kind of like Miles said, I did these pixel models. It was actually for a fashion show in Chicago, all kinds of media. And it was like,
so how does the pixel art mix in with a fashion show?
That's what I had to figure out. So I hadn't done any character stuff yet with pixels. And I was like, well, geez, I don't know what to do. It's a fashion show. Maybe I'll try to make little pixel women that have like look like fashion models.
We have photos. We have really good photos of this.
I know it's online.
I've seen
online.
Them recently. We posted them as part of our 10-year anniversary online celebration.
Right.
They were projected outside of an enormous kind of warehousey building.
Yeah, like big windows or the face of this.
Oh, no, that's right. They were projected on the inside of the windows, but you could see them from the outside.
Right. So it was pretty awesome to see them so big. So we did those, and I was super satisfied with how minimal I could get, but they were still actually looked feminine, these little minimal 3 pixel wide heads and stuff. And then Miles and I were hanging out one day, and I think you were like inspired by the character, like, cause Flash had come so far and you could start, and you said something like, I could probably make that move. One of them move if with arrow keys. And like, wow, that's amazing. And we started thinking about making games. And we did this like prototype adventure clone.
Yeah, like Atari 2600 adventure clone.
As Miles kind of learned the gaming chops a little bit. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, I worked on an animation cycle, like a walk cycle for the character. And then I gave it to Miles, and then he plugged it in. And then we got to make the character move on the screen. And then we flipped out and realized that, oh my God, we can make games.
We literally flipped.
Yeah, all around the living room. And that was pretty much, you know,
the
beginning. And it was so exciting. It just kind of continued.
So you're self-taught programming in Flash. You make Rat Maze, and Rat Maze, I guess, was just like, you know, a stress reliever, if not, or a creative valve release.
We wanted to release something, and we knew Gamma Rose wasn't going to get released anytime soon. So we kind of ripped out the ripped the coat out from Gamma Rose and stuck a rat in it.
Okay.
Right, man. Gave collision boundaries for a maze and put cheese in it.
So, I mean, you know what? It's funny, like, the attention that Rat Maze got at the time. Like, if we release Rat Maze now, it would just be like a sneeze.
It would joke, like, but, this is a joke.
But, you know, we've, like, gotten to, like, gaming magazines and stuff. And it's kind of amazing that, you know, like, almost 11 years ago that was what was possible, you know. And it's funny now when I look at all these, like, modern games on Steam, pixel art is, like, just as kind of vibrant as ever. And, you know, it gets panned a lot, but people don't really stop using it. It's kind of like the default art style now for indie games, it seems. Not for all of them, of course. But if you don't have a huge budget for, you know, art, it's you can go really far with it. It's one of the reasons why I think it's still so popular, because you can be very, very expressive with it, where it's really hard to be expressive unless you've got, like, $1 million budget for visuals. So you go one way or the other, you know?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it seems like, you know, I've been, like, focused on the web for so long, and that I take a step back and I see the gaming industry just eating, like, even Hollywood's, like, lunch, if you will, in terms of how much money it generates, right? And so, and just, you know, I'm not, like, you know, like, one of the reasons why I want to talk to you guys is just get a little bit more about the gaming world was, but I feel like, you know, out of loop, you know, but I, you know, I don't play video games that much, but I enjoy them when I do. And I was just like, feel like to make a pixelated, you know, art game seems like a lot of sense in terms of, like you're talking about, Miles, it just saves so much money, but also it's also a challenge to make them, you know, vibrant, you know, make the characters vibrant and, but still be pixelated. And so that's
And it seems like minimalism is kind of like the, I guess now, you know, you've got these, like, low poly 3D games that are, like, really beautiful. Like, That Dragon Cancer is a really good example of a beautiful low poly. I guess, you know,
The Witness.
The Witness isn't low poly.
It's semi.
It's minimal, but
it's a little more low poly than high poly.
I guess.
I mean, I own it and play it. So
there's kind of like a minimal revival going on now, it seems, which is really nice. Nice to know that there's still opportunity for people out there that don't have huge budgets.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind doing low poly stuff someday.
And would you, like, what's that game for the was it iOS, that the Monument? Is that it? Is
Monument
that
Valley.
Monument Valley. Yeah, that's not too minimalist, but it's kind of minimalist.
It's super duper polished.
It's pretty simple and incredibly polished.
Right. Yeah, I feel like.
Did have a really big budget for that game. There's a really interesting breakdown that they posted that described how much it cost to make that and how much they made. And it's you know, they had a really big team behind it.
Oh, really? Yeah. I felt like I have to read the article because I've missed it, because I felt like it was a small team, but they spent like forever on it.
Yeah, so. I mean, it depends on your definition of small.
So like six or eight people.
It was like
or
between
something.
Six and 10 people. To me, that's a big team.
Yeah. Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, totally. I couldn't even imagine.
What's the scope between like Valley versus like the games that you like get for Xbox, or like, you know, the Uncharted,
right,
you know,
like Fallout 4?
Yeah, I mean, that's. That's exactly. Exponentially.
It is a very small team.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's such a huge risk now to, you know, to make a game about anything, really. So you got to go balls out, or, you know, go super minimal.
Right.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah. So there's that, like, when we get back to like the art kind of style of minimalism and pixelation, which, you know, which you've explored like for ever since, you know, back in the day, since I first met you. So is that your calling card, you think, in terms of the games that you have now?
I would say it has turned out to be that way, but I've done non-pixel work now. Our game Last Horizon that came out in November, that was my first non-pixel game. And it was actually our biggest financial success. Maybe Diner Run might have been in the long run. Maybe not.
Yeah, I guess it depends on what you.
It was like a
classify financial success.
Like at launch, I would say.
Yeah, Diner Run over its lifespan has been more of a success.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as just like right out the gate, Last Horizon was definitely the best. Which it feels like the biggest because, you know, it happens all at once.
Right.
But then you spend all the money before you know it's even there. And then
wondering where the next paycheck's coming from. But that, yeah, I'm happy to do more non-pixel games, but I still love it. It's like it hasn't gone away.
Okay. It's still very minimal. It's just, you know, it's like, I mean, I wouldn't even call it low poly because it's not 3D, but it's minimal 2D. You know?
Right, it's minimal pixels. It's not like Sega Genesis style or it's fancy 3D isometric pixels. Right. Yeah, that's Mike's style. It's minimal. I'm actually not the best illustrator, so it's more like doing puzzles at my level, at the level I work at often. And the next three games I'm involved with are all pixel as well. Well, Gamma Bros updates, Diner Run updates, and maybe Bionic Carl if we work on that one. Anyway.
Bunch of maybes. Always
cool. Yeah.
Okay, so well, I guess one of the questions I want to ask is like lessons learned and making games, because I mean you said that hey, you know, you want to say, hey, I can make your pixelated characters move, and so you want to code more in Flash, and so you've had this learning curve over, you know, your career as game developers. You're starting from from square one, if you will.
Yeah.
But just what lessons have you learned in about game development that you wish you would have known before you started?
Right. So there's the technical side of things, and then there's the marketing side of things.
In the business, generally.
Yeah. Technically, you know, it's really hard to pin down what I would have liked to know then. But as far as marketing-wise, there's a lot of lessons learned.
Like
you know, when we started, the market wasn't really that saturated. And if you made a game that was, you know, relatively high quality, you actually had a pretty good chance of getting noticed. You didn't have to, like, spam journalists' inbox over and over again to get any sort of coverage. Now it's so incredibly saturated that you either have to get incredibly lucky or you have to pay a lot of money to kind of strong-arm your way into people's, like, you know, mindshare, I guess. Or I think the mistake that a lot of people make that are making their first game these days is that they don't start talking about their game until like it's almost ready to come out. And we still do the same thing because we have our heads down in game development so much that, for our first 20 games or so, we generally didn't talk about them until they were almost ready to come out. And as anybody these days will tell you, that's a really big mistake.
Yeah, we'd leave like a week for promotion before the game. or not. Potato Man, we didn't even promote until like the day it launched.
The lesson learned is ABC, always be campaigning. even from day one, you know?
Right.
Like, I've got this idea and I'm committed to make it. I'm going to tell everybody about it.
Mm-hmm.
And here's my initial concept and here's my progress. And, you know, there are some people that are just really, really good at that. Remy Ismail, actually don't know if I pronounced his name.
I think so, probably.
From Vlambeer, I think it's a really good example of someone who's ABC in it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, it's.
So it's like always be championing yourself. Is that
campaigning?
Yeah,
campaigning. Okay. Talking about what you're doing, talking to other people, meeting new developers, meeting journalists, going to festivals. That's not necessarily a financial possibility for a lot of people, but there's ways to do it for no money as well. You know, like getting into online communities, getting into game jams, participating in like virtual game jams or game jams within a specific location. Networking, making friends. Really, when it comes down to it, to answer your question, that's part of it. But the other thing is, the more people you know, and the more contacts you have, and the more relationships you have, the more likely you are to succeed. And relationships are actually critical, especially relationships with platform holders, you know, like Apple and Google and Valve or anybody that's like selling your game on their store, having real relationships with them is really, really important. Having relationships with other developers is incredibly important. So, you know, places like GDC and PAX and other conventions are great for meeting people. Really, if you have lots of positive, non-manipulative relationships with people doing the same thing you are, you're much more likely to.
I know what my question is. Is it something that you started doing, or that you feel like you, since you were in the beginning beforehand, you know, you started early before there was a big saturation of the market. Now, do you feel like you still need to do a lot of campaigning, or do you just?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. And we barely did any for like the first 7 or 8 years of our business. Mm-hmm. Mainly because we got in the habit of not really having to do it, because we did a lot of games for hire, mm-hmm. where you just get paid a single amount and you make the game, and it's, you know, how well the game does is kind of incidental.
Right. And someone else is marketing if they want to.
Right.
And we didn't own the game. So.
Okay. So as far as Dino Run went, it marketed itself pretty well because it was multiplayer and it had a community.
And free online.
Yeah. So these days, though, you know, if your game isn't the most amazing thing that's ever been released and you want people to know about it and buy it, you need some sort of hook. And the hook could be something in the game, or it could just be some way that you talk about it. You know, some of the best advice is just always talk about your game no matter what you're doing. Okay. There's ways to do that without sounding like an egomaniac. You know, people kind of expect developers to talk about their game anyway, mm-hmm. like when they're on social media or wherever they are. Okay. Yeah, like at a restaurant, you just start randomly talking to
the server or something like that. Yeah. You just never know that. Yeah. Yeah, I feel it's something that I've had to kind of get used to. It's just always talking about what I'm doing. I've written like 10 books about the web, but like it felt like the last couple of books were just like no one knew about them until after I was done writing them. I was like, oh, well, I should have probably told people I was writing a book, you know?
Yeah.
instead of being a fool and just working on the book, you know, it's just.
Right, get them hyped and psyched.
Now, I mean, isn't it kind of the publisher's job to also market them a bit, or no?
I don't know. Like, I don't want to like throw publishers underneath the bus, but because they're all great people. But so it's part of the job. But also, I think it's what's called I think authorship, it's just if you have enough followers, it doesn't really matter what you want to write, because the publisher just wants to put a book out there. So if you have enough of a following. You know, so by having those relationships with other developers and reporters and some of that, you get the buzz for it. And so when you're ready, it's built in, locked in. So it's pretty.
A lot of people will look at the successes, and unfortunately, almost all the successes are statistical outliers. And you look at, you know, how they got their success. Some of them were just lucky. Some of them did incredible things. Then once you're there, it becomes so much easier to actually market your stuff after that. But getting there in the first place is the really tough part. Mm-hmm. And the path we've had to basically forge is just working with our fans and mm-hmm. community of people that enjoy what we do. We've never had any like major press coverage for any of our games. Never had like a review in a major magazine.
Wired or something like that.
Or even, you know, any of the major video game blogs like Kotaku or Polygon.
We've had reviews.
Not official reviews. People have mentioned what we're doing. I've never seen like an official review with like a score that would like show up on Metacritic or something like
that. I see.
Yeah. I've never seen any of that. Now, for mobile games, it's actually very different. It seems to be, I don't know why this is, but it seems to be a lot easier to get coverage for mobile games in the major blogs.
Mm-hmm.
And for us, but as far as PC games, the competition is fierce for both, but for PC games, generally it seems to be even harder because there's so many people doing really, really interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's kind of good. The competition is good. It forces people to make better and better games. It's not necessarily good for someone with stars in their eyes that thinks they're going to be the next Wambeer or a Cappy or something like that. because those people get looked up to and they think they can replicate their success by kind of doing the same thing they did. But usually the things that those people did, they only worked at that time. And, you know, next year, the way you get coverage or get interest is going to be totally different.
Okay.
So it's constantly changing. The rules are always changing. So.
Okay. And there's no way to actually learn, you know, learn those rules without actually doing game development, right?
So. Exactly. Yeah. Right. You really need a lot of experience under your belt. Really, like, I'd have to say, most people, they probably just expect success just for making a really good game. But popular saying is that that's the baseline for getting any sort of coverage, is making a really good game. And then after you've made a really good game, if you're going to get noticed and if you're going to make sales, you have to do a lot more work after that. Right. If you don't even have a good game to start with, you might as well just forget about it.
Okay. Oh man! So, in terms of technology, in terms of programming, what do you guys use right now? Because, you know, Flash is, you know, not as popular as it was once before.
So. Yeah, we're using. We have legacy games to support, like Dino Run, stuff like that. That's all Flash. But for new games, we're using Hacks. You familiar with Hacks at all?
I am not familiar with Hacks.
It's like a meta language that compiles natively into other languages, H-A-X-E. It's all open source. There's a foundation that created it, but they don't necessarily own it. You don't have to pay anybody anything to use it.
Okay.
There's a huge online community of people that are constantly improving it. It's really awesome, actually. And a lot of people really don't know much about it. It's interesting. But, you know, it's I love it personally. It was kind of a no-brainer transition, especially for a lot of people that were Flash developers, because the syntax is extremely similar to Flash. And more so by a framework that lays on top of it called OpenFL. It kind of mimics the Flash API. So, and it's not necessarily for people that used to do Flash. Anybody can use it. But you can export to HTML5 or Mac, Windows, Linux, Android, iOS, and then a bunch of other, not lesser known, but more obscure platforms as well.
It's not a platform just for games, right?
Well, you can do anything in it, yeah. It's probably most well known for games, but you could create any app in it that you wanted to. You can create web pages in it, but it's not exactly super efficient because there's a lot of like underlying frameworks, and you don't necessarily want to load a meg or two of frameworks to go to a website. But with an app or a game, it's not a big deal.
So Rich.
Yes.
Any technology changes since the Photoshop, since you zoom in, zoom out in Photoshop, anything? I don't want to say that you just use Photoshop.
Not really. Just Photoshop keeps getting updated and I can zoom in a little farther. Yeah.
There's pixels within pixels, guys. I don't know.
Yes. Right. Now you can edit the pixels of a pixel.
Like macro pixels.
We've gone Retina.
Right. Well, yeah, the one nice thing about Retina we found is that before our games didn't scale well at all. And when we did scale them up for full screen, we had to scale them in increments of like multiple original size.
Yeah.
Else everything would look distorted. But now since the onset of Retina, we can just scale it to whatever size we want.
Nice.
It doesn't have to be a whole number, you know, and then it'll look good pretty much at any scale.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
It's a nice side effect of Retina and pixel graphics.
Right. You know how you look at a pixely game or something and a typeface will have, it'll just look messed up. Each little line is not quite right. Yeah, it fixes that.
Yeah, because computer has always tried to anti-alias it, and try to fudge it a little bit and make it smoother. And
Right. That as well.
Yeah.
Ugly.
Computer's doing you a favor. Like, it's ugly. Like, sorry, Rich. Oh, man.
It's all good now.
Cool. So I do want to talk about crowdsourcing for the apps, because I know you guys have tried Kickstarters, because that's one of the things, like, that kind of leads itself to campaigning, always be campaigning, which is something I learned just a few minutes ago. and that you need to know in game development. So it helps, you know, using Kickstarter. So how was your experience with Kickstarter, and was it successful attempts or
whatnot? Yeah, we had a successful attempt a long time ago for Glorkian Warrior, which it never became unsuccessful, but it kind of succumbed to a typical, not Kickstarter problem, a crowdfunding problem of kind of not exactly knowing what we were going to build when we were just figuring out how much money we were going to ask for. And of course, as with most development projects, the scope increases after you start. We weren't really that far along in the game before we kickstarted it. So we realized we needed like 10 times more money than we actually asked for. Yeah. So, and then we rebuilt the game like 3 times, and we eventually did deliver it, but 4 years after we said we would. But it's funny that nobody actually complained, which is super weird.
Yeah.
There were people that like would ask, when's the game coming? But you know, a lot of Kickstarter campaigns, if you go, the ones that are taking a really, really long time to come out, most of their comments were like, oh, you scammed us. You know, this game's never going to come out. Why did they give you money? Blah, blah, blah. We somehow dodged that. I don't know exactly why. I think it's because ours was really early on. It was like in 2010 or 2011 before it really blew up, or Kickstarter blew up, or crowdfunding in general.
Right. It was only $10,000 we raised.
Yeah. And also we were really forthcoming with people. Anybody that asked a question, we always answered them. And then we let people know. It was constant apologies for like 4 years until we released it.
Excuses.
But that goes a long way. And, you know, I think now that crowdfunding campaigns are much bigger, and we had maybe like 200 backers or something. Mm-hmm. Your typical success now could have like 5,000 backers or 10,000.
Right. Yeah, the Mystery Science Theater reboot had like, I don't think $14 million at least or something like that. But you could tell that it was a 30-day production, you know, that every day they're like doing something. And
that's true too, yeah.
And so it's a different world now if you want to
Totally, yeah. And I think what happens sometimes if it starts to take a lot longer than people thought it would, or than the creators thought it would, you start seeing some concerned comments, and then you start seeing some nasty comments. Yeah. And then since there's so many people, I think a lot of times the creators get, I'm not going to say scared, but they see all the nasty comments and they don't really know how to respond, because it's overwhelming to see all that negativity. Right. Towards you, and then that creates a negative feedback loop where the creators don't actually respond to anything because they don't want to like pipe up and respond to a positive comment and ignore the negative comment. So a lot of times you'll see positive and negative, but no response from the creators whatsoever, because I think they're really overwhelmed, probably mainly by the negative ones. And so to step back a bit, our first crowdfunding experience was positive and negative. Positive in that, you know, it was successful and we actually did ship a game from it. The next one, we were asking for a lot more money. That was for like a Dino Run sequel. But we didn't make that amount of money. And I think we made a little more than half of what we were asking for. And then after that, we started thinking a lot, like how can we improve the process? Not improve Kickstarter. I don't think you can really do that. Like at the time when we launched our kind of do-it-yourself crowdfunding campaign for Dino Run last year, maybe about 6 months, 5 or 6 months ago, we were definitely feeling like a lot more anti-traditional crowdfunding. But these days, I would say, you know, Kickstarter and Indiegogo, Kickstarter in particular, because they're kind of like the behemoth of this whole scene. I think they do what they do really, really well. I don't think anybody's going to do what they do better. I think a lot of the problems come from the misunderstanding of what Kickstarter is used for, or what its purpose is.
And what is that? Just define it.
I mean, if the bottom line is to raise a bunch of money for something you're interested in. Like, a lot of people think that Kickstarter is there to enforce a bunch of rules after it's been successful. They provide you with the means to communicate with people. But the thing that we were trying to address with our like roll your own campaign was the lack of transparency that creators generally get into with their backers after they get funded, right, or even during the campaigns.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Kickstarter. I used to be like, I think I've backed 60 projects and yeah, and it's like, hey, that's a cool idea, and like I kind of don't do that as much as I do now because I don't know, it's kind of crazy. But I tell people, just if you like the idea but you don't want more junk in your house, I need more stuff in my house, just back it for $1 and just get status updates because even that is pretty cool to see how a project comes together. If you're a management nerd like I am sometimes, but even if I back something, I'm pretty much like placing a bet and saying, I would love to see this happen, but if not, I'm okay seeing this, $20 or whatever, $50, whatever, not show up and materialize on my doorstep. I appreciate your idea. Thanks for sharing it with us, but if it doesn't happen, just make sure it's a authentic attempt at making it happen. Things happen, people get, life happens and some of that. So there's only one thing where I'm upset where it didn't happen, but other than that, I mean, in terms of the success rate for Kickstarter having is pretty good.
Yeah. Totally.
So, but I can totally understand, but there's other projects that they don't materialize, I call it like the Google, the Kickstarter wave. Sometimes I get packages in the mail from Kickstarter projects all within the same week, but I back them at different times of my life, they all just kind of materialize at the same time.
That's interesting. It's weird.
But I can totally see your point where but Kickstarter is about making things, allowing people to make things that they would never do in a traditional sense of like asking investors for money. So when you say the anti-crowdfunding crowd, which is sort of like weird because like, isn't anti-crowdfunding asking for big amounts of money from like Hasbro or something like that? I'm not sure. So.
Right. Yeah. I think I should clarify and say it was like kind of anti-crowdfunding culture. Okay. And the culture was, at the time, it was get a bunch of money, be silent for 2 years, and then do or do not produce something after those 2 years. And so we were, the whole idea with the Dino Run thing was we had like a roadmap where it had a bunch of milestones and what our exact plan, and then we broke each milestone down into tasks. Anyone that's ever used project management software, they have like to-do lists and they check them off. We were trying to make that visible to everybody. Like, here are our tasks. Here's how long we think it's going to take to do each task. And then when we do the task, we record how long it actually took so people get an idea of like how good our estimations were. If things go wonky, there's some sort of quantifiable data as to why they didn't go, why we thought they would go that way. We've still been working on them since Dynarun came out, and we still have kind of like revelations and pivot points as to how it should all work. The idea now is that it really goes back to like the ABC principle. So when you have an idea for something, there's this gap between, I have an idea and I'm going to get on Kickstarter for it. Like, what do you do between idea and Kickstarter? Because you need to get a lot of stuff together these days to have a successful Kickstarter campaign. It's, when we did Glorkian Warrior, we literally just had an idea. We had like two or three concept art, like pieces of concept art, a cool idea, an indie famous comic book artist. And that's all it really took. But these days, if you go on Kickstarter and you just explain your idea and you have a few pieces of concept art, you're going to get filleted. you got to really prove that you know what you're doing. So the way our, you could call them tools or whatever, the tools we've been working on are now to address that. How do you campaign before and after Kickstarter, or before and after like a major money infusion? What do you do right before early access, Steam early access, if you're making a game, or So you have some music. What do you do between having a, you know, a few cool tracks and a completed album? And so, yeah, that's kind of what we're trying to address now is those major gaps between those, to kind of encourage people, give them some ways to keep people informed and educated, and just keep the lines of communication clear between developer and creator. I mean, between creator and the public, anyone who's interested in what you're doing, basically. Because I don't think just like a comment thread is really good enough.
So we're saying like you're working on a new crowd sourcing or funding system. Is that right? Is it so that
I wouldn't even say we're working on a new crowdfunding system now, because that implies that we're actually trying to like compete with Kickstarter and Indiegogo and other and Patreon.
Okay.
Stuff like that. I think unless we had tons of money and muscle behind us, I think that's kind of like a losing bet.
Yeah.
I think these days we're, you know, a really good example is BackerKit. BackerKit, you know, they just kind of like, what's the best word to describe what they do? They kind of add on to your Kickstarter experience. They make it better, right? Mm-hmm. So like...
Yeah, for the developer and the...
Yeah, I think that's what we're focusing on now is how to make the Kickstarter experience more valuable for the developer, for the creator, and for the people that are going to back it. And how do we add that extra layer of transparency or accountability or communication or, you know, any of those things that are pretty necessary when a bunch of people give you money?
Oh, so BackerKit just sounds, it just adds more value to your Kickstarter campaigns or like,
It's like when you get to the checkout line, it's like a bunch of extra things you can buy. Right. That's not all they do, but that was my major experience with it. I thought it was pretty cool. Like, you know, when something Hyperlight Drifter just released and, you know, you get this link that says, hey, it's time for you to collect that thing that you, you contributed to so long ago. And then, you know, this whole experience of like, oh, I'm actually a hardcore fan and I want to order this, that, and the other thing.
Right.
Supplement my experience.
Because they show it to you as you're checking out. All these other things you didn't know existed.
Yeah.
Right, because they added a lot. It seems like they added a lot since they kicked it off. Or I just wasn't aware of those things. Or maybe now, like, I only had $10 when I supported it, and now 3 years later when it's out, I have $100 to spend on a project.
Right. So why not
try to upsell me on that stuff?
Exactly.
Cool. It was a cool idea, and it just kind of supplements the... and. You know, adds value to the whole experience. So that's where we're at now with it. We're trying to add value and just
fill the gaps.
Fill the gaps. Yeah.
Yeah. We see there's a void here where there's help is needed, and how can our tools facilitate?
Right.
Okay. So basically you have like so I'm not sure, would you have a name for her?
Well, the tent, like the unofficial company name is E70. And that's actually, I think we came upon that for a couple of reasons. One, originally, I think it was just like a placeholder name that we just got used to. It's a European highway. I mean, it's also a Nokia phone and
like a model. Yeah.
Like a car model.
Is that your favorite phone? Your favorite phone?
No.
Okay.
Nope. I learned that after the fact. But but it's basically a set of tools. It's like five or six tools we have right now. One is for just like taking money and taking some sort of action after that transaction is successful. One is for keeping track of rewards. One is for keeping track of people that have given you money. One is for organizing your business plan and your milestones and all the tasks of each milestone. One is for managing kind of like your street team, the people that are interested but not necessarily giving you money, kind of mobilizing the people that are going to help promote you.
Okay.
Yeah, but we're always improving them, and eventually I think we're going to make them public, probably pretty soon, but we've been saying that for a while.
Oh, do you have a website for it?
No, there is no website for them just yet. There's a dashboard that people could actually use to like start new projects. It actually works, but we're just being really slow and steady and cautious with it.
Yeah, we've been at it for about 2.5 years.
Yeah.
Figuring out what are the pain points? How can
it started, can we do? The impetus for it was the failed second Kickstarter campaign.
Right, Dino Run 2.
So your lessons learned is like you didn't feel like that Kickstarter campaign you didn't feel like it was enough for you to like, was that a lesson you learned just like, say, instead of having a big massive buildup for a campaign that you Kickstarter, yet like this massive undertaking to do it, you'd say, well, instead of just doing this massive buildup and getting all this money all at once, what if we just set milestones, tell people what they are, and if you reach a certain milestone in terms of financial,
right,
we'll make this much of the game, and if we get this far, we'll flesh it out some more. And so,
that's how Dino Run worked, but that won't necessarily work for every idea. Like it's pretty risky for a really really big game.
Yeah,
you know, imagine a huge game. It's like, okay, if we raise $50,000, we're going to make 10% of this game, and then 10% of it gets made because they don't make more than $50,000. But the money's already been taken. The money's been spent. People can't get their money back. And you have 10% of a really awesome game. For a lot of people, like all you really need is 10 or 20% of a game. And then there are avenues to take like after you get that. You know, you're more likely to find a publisher or have a Kickstarter success.
Mm-hmm. Or, with a playable demo of some sort.
So I think, but one of the things we realized was that for the Dino Run campaign, and for a lot of Kickstarter campaigns, they just appear out of nowhere. Mm. And then, I mean, it's kind of exciting to hear about a Kickstarter campaign out of nowhere for something you didn't know you wanted. But we probably should have been building momentum for that campaign 6 months before it actually started.
Mm-hmm.
Kickstarter should have been like the middle step, not the first step.
Mm-hmm.
So had we been campaigning for Dino Run 2 6 months beforehand, either maybe like raising small amounts of money and making a prototype and building like a big list of people that were going to support it or at least interested in it, not necessarily even giving us money, just people that were on board for the experience, I think it would have had more impact, the actual campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Although in retrospect, personally, I was I was super depressed like halfway through the campaign. But then by the time it was over, I was incredibly relieved. Because I think like it wasn't the right project for us at the time. Okay. That's just my personal opinion. That's not the opinion of everybody that was involved. I would like to see the game made. But under the circumstances, it didn't seem like the right thing to do at that time. Mm-hmm. And if it ever happens again, it will happen under very different circumstances. So,
okay. Is that revenge call here?
Revenge?
Yeah, it will happen underneath them.
Revenge circumstances.
Like revenge.
No, I think of it as revenge. Hopefully it's not like some sort of subconscious attempt at revenge.
Who would the revenge be against?
I'll get you Kickstarter this time.
No. We don't harbor any ill will. I think that, you know, there probably was a point. I think a lot of people, they get upset at Kickstarter when Kickstarter kind of bites them in the ass. But it's really the way they used Kickstarter that bites them in the ass, not Kickstarter itself.
Yeah.
Like, I remember, like, not naming names, but really big projects that actually made their, like, well, almost, can't remember if it even made its amount, but somebody blaming Kickstarter for being all or nothing because it made them tell a bunch of half-truths
about
what they were going to put in the game. And they were, like, trying to make their deadline, so they started promising a bunch of things they couldn't actually deliver, which is classic.
Yeah.
I think everybody we know, including ourselves, that's ever done a major crowdfunding campaign starts promising things they can't actually deliver on because they just want to make that goal. And they have this attitude that if I make that goal, everything will be okay and I'll just figure it out. But that's that state of mind that of basically desperation.
Yeah.
Like, most people we know that have run major all or nothing crowdfunding campaigns definitely felt desperate right in the middle of it and towards the end. And for the few that like made their goals and then like way over, they probably didn't feel that. It was probably just like, you know, euphoria the whole way. But for the majority of them that did make their goals, they didn't necessarily like bust their goal by like 500%. There's definitely that sense of desperation, like I'll do anything to make this goal. And I don't really care what happens afterwards. I just need to make that goal because I put so much into this campaign. I can't not make that goal.
Right.
But what's actually worse, like what's much worse than not making your goal is having 5,000 angry strangers asking you, where's that thing you promised?
Right. And all the other things you promised at the end.
So I'm really glad that didn't happen. Yeah.
Exactly. Cool. I totally understand that. But, so what are you guys working on in the future? So you guys, Game of Brothers 1.5, is that next? Is that?
Yeah, that is the very next thing. We actually are going to, the date seems solid. I guess it could be tentative, but it seems solid, like April 21st. We're going to launch another kind of do-it-yourself campaign. I wouldn't really call it a crowdfunding campaign because we are going to make GIMP Bros 1.5 no matter what happens. But it's really just more like a promotional pre-order, like limit. It's like a 4-week campaign that we're doing before Steam Early Access. So we have these theories about, marketing and how our tools can be used. And, you know, we're basically running all of our projects through these tools to see how these theories work out. And so the current theory is that, you know, we can have our own funding campaign before we go on a major platform to gather like the hardcore fans and early adopters and get them on board and get them interested before we actually have like our major platform release.
Like a Steam Early Access.
Yeah. And then also, anybody that's doing marketing can tell you the more like, quote unquote events you have, the better. Mm-hmm. So we have like this kind of pre-launch and then early access, which isn't exactly a launch. It's like another pre-launch. Yeah. And then you get out of Steam Early Access and then you like do your launch proper. And then you do an update after that. That's another event. Mm-hmm. Anything that you can kind of justify popping on to like social media and your mailing list and saying, hey, this major thing just happened, check it out. Because it looks really pathetic when it's like 4 months after you released your game and you just say, hey, remember this thing we did? Instead of just, hey, there's something new. This is like an event. Here's a good reason for you to kind of check out what we did if you didn't before. So we're definitely going to use these slightly improved tools for the Dynarun campaign to raise some money for Game Bros. And most importantly, we're going to kind of bake the roadmap into the actual game. So like for the early access version, at least, so that when you play the game, like on the title screen or something like that, you can actually see the progress we're making and you can, you know, there's more involvement that people can actually feel like their early contribution or their early access sale, the money actually went to like a tangible improvement in the game.
Right.
Instead of the typical scenario, which is in early access, we've seen is just like, you don't really know where your money's going. You don't actually know if the game is going to get finished. You're just hoping it does. And there's no way of actually knowing that. So we're trying to put in, to let people know this is where your money's going, or at least these are the things that your money is accelerating within our progress.
Cool. That sounds pretty awesome. And any other games on the horizon?
So Gamma Bros is one thing. We're still making updates to Dynarun because that campaign is ongoing. It's not a limited time campaign. So as we meet milestones for that, we're making updates. And then we're also working on a game with Imagos Softworks, like kind of like a spin-off game to their game Star Mazer. Star Mazer had a successful Kickstarter campaign about a year ago, and then the game that Pixel Jam is working on with them is like a spin-off game to that. It's a pretty kind of like a manic horizontal shooter with like some roguelike stuff.
In space.
And then there's a few games that we've been working on for quite a while that are kind of in limbo, I would guess. There's one like called Wrath of Pegasus that...
Yes.
Have you seen...
Yeah, we actually had this naming email thread.
You're right.
Yeah, so I gave you a whole bunch of list of names. I think you guys are stuck with Wrath of Pegasus.
Did you name that game, Chris?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
No, I think you guys are like, I think we're going to name it Wrath of Pegasus. And I gave you like a list of 20 names or something, or 10 names, whatever. You're like, yeah, we're sticking with Wrath of Pegasus.
Yeah, I appreciate your ideas.
No, it's fun.
You know, it gets worked on and off.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like in the queue, you know, we're a small company and it's not a good idea to work on 5 things at once.
Oh, well, that's how it goes sometimes.
So
it does go that way sometimes.
Yeah. And then, you know, we have another album of kind of like Pixel Jam inspired music that I assume Pixel Jam's Volume 2. And then there's another project with
Pixel Jam inspired music. That sounds like people are inspired by Pixel Jam and they're making music.
No, but it's not music from games. It's just music by Pixel Jam people and our friends. And then, you know, there's a couple other things on the sidelines. But really, I think for me personally, the main focus are these tools we're working on. And just trying to figure out exactly what they are and how we're going to explain them to people. Because before it was, you know, we're gonna compete with people that you really shouldn't compete with.
Right, we'll be the alternative to and that, established major brands.
That's not a good idea.
Right, we haven't created our own category, really.
And so
at that point,
yeah, I think we're really close to figuring out why they're useful and how people can use them. So
okay, awesome.
That's the thing I'm probably most excited about right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool, awesome. Well, thank you guys so much for taking time of your day to speak with me.
Yeah, thank you.
No problem. So where can people find you on the internets?
Pixeljam.com, PIXELJAM.
Yeah. Right, and at Pixeljam Games for Twitter, PIXELJAM.
GAMES.
Why did the screen just go black?
It does that every now and then.
And what else? We have a Pixel Jam Facebook. And
yeah.
We have a DoomSurf. At DoomSurf is Twitter for Dino Run. And we're going to get one going for Gamma Bros at Gamma Bros 15.
Yeah, that's actually there as well.
Yeah, I emailed or I direct messaged the... I just tweeted that because I couldn't direct message. The person that owns at Gamma Bros, who is using like the Minecraft skins of Gamma Bros and like tweeted like 10 or so tweets in 2013 and left it alone.
Are you threatening him?
Not yet. So far, it's been friendly. It's like, hey, you mind if we use this? Because Gamma Bros is coming back. I didn't hear anything.
Catch you.
Yeah. Gonna send them after you.
Oh, well. We're gonna send our goons.
These bros, they're gonna pay you a visit in their spaceships.
Yeah.
Cool. And they just are Italian. You know, but,
actually, not at all. No Italian.
All right, cool. Well, again, thanks for being here, and I'll talk to you soon, I hope.
Yep.
Good talking with you.